From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I'll never forget doing one day we were doing class and the teacher said, okay, it's time for PE. Go run around the caravan six times.
Yes, it's the most most popular sport in the world. You know, historians like Tom Holland argue it's the most popular sport that's ever existed.
Who does the nest stealing? Is it the male or the female? Or
it's entirely the female. So the male's sole job in the partnership, if you can even call it that, is the mating. And then his job is done.
Coming up on this new month, same foolishness edition of Playback Daily, there's no need to run away to join the circus if you're born into it. Overpaid, overhyped and overworked, football congestion is becoming a problem. And never called, never wrote, how cuckoos come here every year to mate and then we never see them again. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show, but desperately wants to run away and join the circus, but is afraid of heights, animals and other people. It's the first day of a new month, and on his monologue this morning, Oliver Callan finds that sometimes a story is just black and white.
The Irish Daily Mail has a photograph of a zebra foal in a pub in County Clare. What is going on here? The appearance of a foal zebra from the Ennis Diamond Horse Fair in County Clare has prompted calls for legislation around the ownership of exotic animals, kind of highlighting that basically there aren't many controls once you have them into the country. The foal zebra was photographed basically in different parts around Ennis Diamond, including one local pub. There are posts online when they obviously went viral. People are going, what on earth is going on here with a zebra inside a pub? A spokesman for the fair said he knew of the zebra's involvement but added they had not seen the animal. And obviously they weren't involved in bringing the zebra around. The Clare dog warden, Frankie Coote, explained there's no extra legal obligations for exotic animals beyond paperwork and licensing upon imports. So he's pointing out, basically told the Clare Champion that you need a license for a dog, but not for a lion and a tiger. So bringing them into the country is very, very difficult because of all the paperwork that are needed. But says once they're here, there's not much you can do. If there's animal welfare concerns, then that's different. But that's not the case here. There's been nothing to suggest the animal looks healthy. It's a young animal. And Frankie says, obviously, the father and mother must be here as well. He says, really proper legislation should be brought in to cover this. The person bringing the zebra around could have been walking around with a lion or a tiger. And there's nothing legally that you can do about that. It's quite an extraordinary tale.
Of course, the zebra would be better if it was a zebra plus, because, as we all know, everything is improved by the addition, see what I did there, of a plus.
GAA Go is no more. We knew that. They've been releasing the details, the GAA, of the new streaming service. The streaming platform is now GAA Plus, because everything has to have a plus on it now at this stage. And the details, 40 championship games this season. It's quite expensive. A season pass, €79. And there's no early bird. I think there has been in previous years a benefit from the early bird. You get a 10% discount via Firin, which we think is... I think club members or club players, not sure. The GA doesn't explain it here. €79 for the season pass, which is seasonally in the championship, runs until July nowadays. £90 if you're in Britain, and the rest of the world is €120. Also, you can pay per game €12. And but the news here is that all caregiving institutions will receive a free season pass this time through the HSE and NHI, which is Nursing Homes Ireland. There's no mention of the north here, but I presume it's the same thing in the north for the NHS up there in caregiving situations. That'll be free. My gripe about it when you pay for it is you missed a game, and if you go to watch the same thing again because it's a streaming platform, it's on demand, it's not there. You don't get to watch it unless they've updated that. There's no details on that. They can let us know. That's GAA Plus, no longer GAA Go.
GAA Go, I hardly knew you. Wait, is there more sports-related news? There certainly is.
In rugby news, good news down in Munster, because Jack Crowley is going to stay. He's agreed a new contract with the province. He's 25 years of age. We talked here a couple of weeks ago about the fact that obviously there's a very generous offer coming to him from the Leicester Tigers. It was reputed to be £750,000 a year, but he's opted to remain in Ireland, which will demonstrate how much he wants to stay here, play for Munster and stick in Ireland. His provincial contract will be much less than that. And it's kind of the Jack Crowley story is a fascinating one. He played every minute of the Six Nations last season when we retained the title post Johnny Sexton, and then he started the summer test in South Africa, the opening games of the autumn internationals. But then, of course, Sam Prendergast took up the number 10 in the two November tests, and the most of the Six Nations, Jack Crowley was only wheeled out the last game against Italy, where he did extremely well. And of the 14 players currently under central contracts with the RFU for next season, Tadhg Byrne is the only Munster representative in the group, which includes no out-halves. So Jack Crowley hasn't got a lot of out-half time, basically, this season, which is unfortunate. But anyway, the key thing is he's staying here, because if he'd left to join Leicester, the chances of being selected from Ireland would be very diminished, and be kind of like a decision made sort of thing. Another thing that would have turned him off Leinster is they've no coach at the moment, so it would have been a big risk to go flying over there, that's for sure. But he's staying here, so that's the good news.
We'll take whatever good news we can get. So, yep, great. Glad to hear it. Love it. Fantastic. And meanwhile, in the house full of people making holy shows of themselves.
Now, could this be an April Fool's on a day of such high and lowbrow political drama? The Independent TD Barry Heenan has announced dramatically he's going to move seats in the Dáil Chamber away from Tipperary TD Michael Lowry. This scoop comes courtesy of Micheál Lehane of the political staff here in RTE. And the Dublin Bay North TD is understood to be annoyed over what, fair enough, he's described as toxic and intimidating behaviour towards him after he was photographed, or well, he was videoed, beside the Tipperary TD, Michael Lowry, when he gave the infamous two fingers gesture to Paul Murphy. He was doing the filming in the Dáil Chamber, and I presume he's going to be in trouble for filming. We haven't heard anything yet. Michael Lowry, of course, has somewhat apologised for it. That statement, we leave it to your own judgment. Barry Heenan, for his part, I don't think he's criticised Michael Lowry, from what I could see around the place. And nor has he fallen out with Michael Lowry, because he's also going to remain part of the regional technical group. But he's written to Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Do you really have to write to the Taoiseach to say you're moving seats? Evidently so. He's written to him to say that he's going to commit supporting the programme for government. Also, it must be something to do with Micheál showed up and said, he's sitting in a different seat. Now he's got the letter go. He hasn't fallen out with him. He's leaving because he gets a lot of abuse, it seems, for sitting next to Michael Lowry. One wonders why that would be. So there you go. He hasn't fallen out. He's just moving chairs. So Barry Heenan, he's an interesting guy. He's not even 30 years of age. Young TD, first time TD, a protege of Finian McGrath. He's a Clontarf TD, and he's independent, and he says this is highlighting his independence. He's in a group, but he still remains an independent TD. Derided, of course, by the Labour Party and others, I heard saying in the Dáil Chamber, as a Lowry lackey, because he's included in that collective term they gave them. Maybe Finian Minion actually would have been a better, but he's very much his own man, of course. But there you go, new TD. He has a chance to prove himself. It's only new, but of course the Dáil would have to function in order for him to get to do prove himself. But under the new rules, if they go ahead tomorrow, he'll be allowed to ask questions of the leader who he's in a programme for government with.
It all makes complete sense and is absolutely how governments, oppositions and parliaments are supposed to work. And here, Oliver brings us more evidence of how seamlessly and efficiently government-adjacent institutions go about their business.
Farmley is in the papers today, the state guest house. Apparently it's Senan Maloney here writing the Irish Independent. It says new figures have revealed the property is averaging only two stays a year by foreign officials. This was supposed to be a great guest house for the state and so on, but they've spent a fortune on it. It costs roughly, given the number of people, they've done that calculation based on the number of people stay there, it's cost £750,000 per delegation who spent the night there. A response to a parliamentary question shown Farmley House used only twice a year for the past 5 years, generally short stays, one night only. And there are 18 bedrooms, are there really, in the main house? 18 empty bedrooms. Not as if we have a accommodation problem or anything in the country. It also has a barely used heated swimming pool for guests, which costs more than €575 a month to maintain, excluding the heating costs. Oh, that should be higher than that. Barely used. Well, who's using it then? Because there's nobody staying there. 70 people have arrived since the year 2000. Nobody has stayed in the house this year. Well, if they looking for someone, I'm available to check it out and do a review of the house. Of course, I would do it absolutely as part of it would be a public service to hang out in Farmley for a night. The government has spent £52 million buying the property, refurbishing it. That's working out at £750,000 over the last 24 years. But Farmley is a popular destination for Dubliners, and every Sunday it's thronged with visitors who go around the place. Who has actually stayed there anyway? Britain's Queen Elizabeth II, the late woman herself, Canada's now former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, also the Emperor and Empress of Japan have stayed there overnight.
18 bedrooms makes it sound like it could sleep, I don't know, at least 18 people, and it's averaging just 2 guests a year. Yeah, that sounds like good management, all right. But wait, look over there. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's the BCU. The what now, Gay?
There is good news in the Beatles cinematic universe. That's what they're calling it, because we had heard those rumours of Sam Mendes, who made the movie American Beauty and Skyfall, that there were going to be 4 separate movies, one devoted to each Beatle. He's going to make all 4 biopics, because music biopics are very much du jour at the minute. Bruce Springsteen has one coming out this year. The Bob Dylan one was very good. And you've had Ray Charles and other people along the way. So while you were sleeping in Las Vegas last night, a CinemaCon was happening. And Sam Mendes appeared in a surprise appearance to make this big announcement that he's going to make all of these movies, and they're going to be released in April 2028. So in 3 years' time. And the extra surprise is he brought the cast on stage. Now, there were rumours. Director Ridley Scott, when he was promoting Gladiator 2, he says, oh, I'd love to have Paul Mescal in another film, but unfortunately he's going to be going off doing The Beatles. And everyone went, what? That's not confirmed. And separately, Ringo Starr was online saying that, oh, Barry Keoghan is taking drum lessons, so he's playing me and I hope he does well in it. And I'm going, that's not confirmed either. It has now been officially confirmed overnight. Paul Mescal will be playing Paul McCartney in the Sam Mendes Beatles biopic, cue Beatlemania. And Barry Keoghan will be playing Ringo Starr. So the other announcements are Harris Dickinson, who's a London actor, 29 years of age, recently in Baby Girl with Nicole Kidman. He's going to play John Lennon because he's a long, stringy, sort of sad looking fella. Actually too sad, I'd say, for John Lennon, because he was a bit of crack. And another Londoner, Joseph Quinn, is going to play George Harrison, perhaps the most interesting of the Beatles, because he was nice and quiet in the background. Joseph Quinn was also in Gladiator 2 with Paul Mescal. He played one of the evil emperors. He was very good in it, actually. It was the only good thing about himself and Denzel. The only thing held what was a mess of a film together. But he's best known as Eddie in Stranger Things, the kind of heavy metal dedicated fella in Stranger Things, Joseph Quinn. He is 31. Barry Keoghan is actually the oldest at 32. And they came out on stage. All 4 actors recited lyrics from the band's Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They were all wearing black jumpers and then took a Beatles-style synchronised bow. And Barry Keoghan, it must be for a film he's in, but he looks, I think he looks like Barbra Streisand in the photographs they've circulated online, the PR people. It looks bizarre. But everyone else, they look like young lads. Of course, they're going to be in their 30s making this film, so that would be the end of the Beatles kind of period, wouldn't it?
Yes. And all actors in films are age appropriate to their roles, so that flies, doesn't it? I mean, at the same CinemaCon, it was announced that Tom Holland, currently 28, will play the teenage Peter Parker in a 4th Spider-Man film in 2026. It's all about the optics, isn't it? Or is it? Who can say? Barry Keoghan and Paul Mescal may be able to strum a guitar and play the drums, but can they catch thieves just like flies? Yeah, not sure where this is going either, so maybe this is a good time to exit the monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan and get on with our lives. Fixture congestion in football has long been highlighted, but the footballing calendar just keeps getting more and more bloated. Meanwhile, managers and players warn against burnout, but it doesn't seem to make any difference. Footballing journalist Miguel Delaney joined Claire Byrne this morning to talk about the issue.
First of all, I think for the football we actually see, Kane, as you say, Kane's not the first to say it. Rodri from Manchester City in Spain said it earlier in the season, only to then suffer a long-term injury shortly after that, which should be an alarm bell in itself. But also, I suppose, just for how football works. I mean, like at the moment, football is in this sort of gold rush where, you know, it's booming in America, it's booming in India. Everyone wants to kind of get in these new markets, but no one ever wants to give up any of their own space. So hence you have FIFA, who should really be the ultimate regulator of the sport. They should really be kind of, you know, adjudicating on all these issues and deciding where the calendar goes. Instead, they've become one of the great disruptors because Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, used to be part of UEFA. He was the general secretary of UEFA. He saw how much money the Champions League made. And he basically wants FIFA to have their own version of it in this Club World Cup, which everyone else in football complains has been unilaterally imposed on the rest of the sport. It's going to be a real game changer because at the moment, the top clubs are looking at potential revenue there of $90 million, which far outstrips any other competition. Mm-hmm. It's $90 million. And if given that, no matter how the tournament goes this summer, and remember a lot of the money comes indirectly from Saudi Arabia through the 10% stake in the DAZN broadcaster who have one of the broadcast partners for the company or for the competition. Sorry. Well, the moves are eventually going to go for that the Club World Cup should be every 2 years. Like, everyone sees this as inevitable. And while this argument, I suppose, the players make, nobody will have much sympathy for it because, they'll just see the wages, they'll tell players to get on with it. But ultimately, to me, this comes down to do I want to see Leo Messi at 100% or 50%? Well,
yeah. You see, we do have to turn our perception of footballers on its head here, because like you say, we think about a professional football player and you think about the money that they're on and you look at their lifestyle. They drive their fast car into the grounds, they play a bit of football, then they play video games. Someone gives them a massage and they do a bit more exercise in the afternoon. They play a couple of matches during the week. Like, it looks grand. So does Harry Kane have a point when he says that the concerns they've expressed about all of this have been ignored? And can you understand why they've been ignored?
Remember, this comes as part of this absurd racist football. And yes, players have been ignored, which is why now FIFPro, the major global players' union, have been considering, or have already kind of talked about legal action against FIFA. Because even if you take in all these lifestyle things, let's remember, we're getting charged a lot in terms of broadcasting and in terms of match tickets, certainly at that sort of elite level, and certainly where I am in the UK with the Premier League, to watch football. So if you're getting charged that much, and prices are only going to keep going up given all these competitions and given the competition between them all, are we really seeing what's worth our money? What fans even deserve to see in that sense? Like, that's kind of the knock-on effect here. And I mean, like, look at the most recent example. So FIFA themselves, the week Kane said that, I was there listening to him. It was in the mix zone at Wembley after England's second international game, the one against Latvia. Now, FIFA's recommendation is that there should be 72 hours between any game a player plays. Now, with England, and this was under FIFA's jurisdiction because it was the FIFA World Cup qualifiers, both of those games were within 72 hours of each other. The Friday night game finished at about 9:45. The Monday game started at 7:45. Mm-hmm. So even if FIFA basically can't, so and remember, they are the ultimate authority in all this, can't even sort a calendar that sense. Well, it shows the mess. And there's another one now with that Club World Cup as well, that Kane is in with Bayern Munich, that Bellingham is going to be in with Real Madrid, that the Manchester City players and Chelsea are going to be in. So again, you've got another international break at the end of the season. That goes to about, I think it's the 10th or 11th of June. The Club World Cup starts on the 15th of June. And normally in those cases, FIFA, or if it was the UEFA tournament, they'd want the players in the country 5 days beforehand. But even there, FIFA have just had to shorten it to 3 days to accommodate their own qualifiers. And there is just this sense of a calendar that can't really hold. And I think we're seeing that in more injuries, because injury crises have been an absolute theme of the Premier League season. In a lot of games, they kind of, like, if you look at a recent Champions League finals, there's almost this, and this is supposed to be the pinnacle of the sport, there's almost this sense of kind of, boxers slugging it out at the end of it, you know, at the 12th round, just throwing in whatever they've got left. And again, this isn't the way the sport as it should be, or the sport as you'd want it, should be played.
Yeah, I mean, is there any recourse for the players? I mean, just using that example of the Club World Cup, where their break is shortened now because they'll be travelling and so on, who can they complain to about that if it's FIFA who are bending the rules?
Well, it's why basically there has been talk of legal action and also strike. Now, there is the other side of this, which is basically that the more these competitions get created, it's in keeping with this, what in truth is an insane wage race that has basically driven football for the last 30 years, basically since the Bosman ruling in the 90s, and, you know, when players could move at the end of their, once their contracts ended, they could move for free. Since then, basically, we've had this escalating race. It's almost like football has all these impulses on many different sides, and it's why kind of, you know, we've spoken about this in the show before, but it's that there's such a strange place in its history where, mm-hmm. yes, it's the most popular sport in the world. You know, historians like Tom Holland argue it's the most popular sport that's ever existed, but that's attracted all sorts of interests from the financial to the political, trying to extract some form of capital on this. And it comes at a time when there's a governance crisis for the game.
That's Miguel Delaney, chief football writer with the London Independent, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about fixture congestion in the modern game. Superfit 20-somethings who are all paid six figures a week are upset that they have to play a few more games a season. Bah. Too harsh? Michael is just back from a hardware show in Las Vegas, and he spoke to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about the expected impact of the tariffs that the Orange one will announce on Wednesday.
It was actually quite interesting what was going on over there with the mention of the tariffs happening around the world, especially obviously from the American side of things.
And what are they thinking, saying or worrying about?
Well, basically, most of these stands that were over there, the booths, were actually putting on percentages and then giving a discount to the customers, so to help with the tariffs. So at the end of the day, it's still going to go on to the customer. You know, the consumer is still going to end up paying for it at the end of the day. Everything we ship over, we manufacture in Ireland, we manufacture in the US, and we manufacture in China. But everything we ship over is just going to have a tax that comes in, and it's just going to go on to the consumer. And we're not talking about 25%, because 25% on the import duty becomes nearly four times that. You know, so if you've got a product for €10, it's going to be €12.50 now.
Yeah,
Or it could even be more. We don't know yet.
Yeah, exactly.
That €2.50 becomes €10. So your 40 product becomes $50. So it's not just 25%. It works out a lot more at the end.
I don't fully follow that now. I know 40 obviously goes to 50, but how does
everything works in fives? Okay, when you're manufacturing a product, it goes into fives. Okay. So you have to do distributor, there's middle guys, there's wholesalers, there's retailers, and then there's the consumer. Okay. So everyone has to make a bit of profit out of it. So it all just ends up being added on, unfortunately.
And when you say at the hardware show they were saying 25% discount on tariffs, what are they saying? We'll take the hit, or do they want you to take it? Do they want you to reduce your prices?
Yeah, but what everyone is doing is they open the pricing. Especially the new products, they're upping the price. And say if they were charging €10, they're now charging €12.50, but they're giving the 25% discount to the wholesaler. So they're saying that we're giving back the tariff, you know, so you don't have to pay the tariff if the tariff comes on. So that's basically what's happening.
And who pays the tariff?
Eventually, well, the import, the customer that's buying off me in the US will pay the tariff. And then he will then put it on to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So it just comes on to the consumer all the time.
And how will it affect your business, though? Insofar as you can predict. Okay.
It's already affected it very much so. In October, we were told that we were going to hold off on orders until we find out what the election is about.
Okay.
And then when the election went through, then we were saying we're going to hold off on orders until... we find out what the tariffs are going to be.
Okay.
And even down to yesterday, I got an email from one of our large customers over in the US, and he basically said that we're going to wait until the 11th because we don't know what the European are going to come back. We don't know what's going to happen. So it's even gone even further. So even though he's coming in with the tariffs tomorrow, we're not going to really know what's going to happen until the 11th or 12th of April.
And
so it's very tough.
What is your product, Michael, and how do you think it will be affected?
Well, We're Stayhold. Stayhold is obviously an automotive part. We're also Superhooks, which is the same company. So Stayhold was a removable wall for the trunk of your car, basically. Okay. So the boot of your car. So it stops things from moving around. And we have the utility patent on this since 2013. Developed again in 2015. I mean, it's the OEM then in the US. So we're manufacturing in the US. We also have tariffs in. We're in like the stores over in America. We're in Lowe's, Home Depot. We've been in Walmart, Meijer, all the big companies. It's just you know, and they've all just stopped ordering. You know, they just like stopped waiting to see what happens. It's going to be a product that it's kind of our product would be a necessity in some cases, but it wouldn't be it would be a kind of a luxury product. So we're going to find the luxury products are going to go out of the window. They're not going to buy them. They're going to take in the products that are needed and maybe not the luxury products. So you'll find it, I think it'll go worldwide. Because when the tariffs go back and forward, we're going to have trouble. Yeah. So.
And have you already had orders postponed?
Yes. We've had three orders postponed already. Yeah. and quite large orders, you know. So now we know they will come, but, you know, they will come when everything is like settled and all that. It's just, you know, we went through COVID already. We were doing very, very well before COVID. Okay. Then COVID hit us, you know, and then we coming out of COVID, we had a fantastic year last year. And then all of a sudden this hit us there in October. So it's like, you know, you never know what's going to happen anymore. It's just, it's
well,
quite
what,
scary.
What President Trump thinks will happen is somebody will start manufacturing what you manufacture, Stayhold, or a replica of it or something similar. An American company, it'll never come back to you because his idea is an American company will start manufacturing it.
Well, we have a utility patent on it, so we're patented, okay. So they can't actually copy it. But what they can do is they can make us manufacture in the US. Yeah. What happens there is, which we already are manufacturing in the US, it's 3 times the price to manufacture.
Wow.
So you're even the tariffs, even the customers are saying, okay, even if it's 25% or 40% or whatever, it's still going to be cheaper than manufacturing in the USA. And especially if these tariffs come in, the consumer's going to go up, the economy's going to go up, not going to be able to afford the wages to manufacture. The price of manufacturing will go up in America. It's a kind of a domino effect.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not going to stop until someone has some sense and turns around and says, okay, this is what we can do, this is what we'll do. But, I mean, it's going to just keep on tariff against tariff. We all know that China's they'll just put on tariffs as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the Europe are going to put on tariffs, maybe. Canada, tariffs, everyone's going to just put on tariffs and everyone's just going to be paying more. It's the consumer. It's nobody else but the consumer is going to be paying more. And then the economy goes up and all of a sudden we've got, you'd be going with a wheelbarrow for a bottle of milk in the US soon, you know, with a full of cash.
And the wheelbarrow, as happened in the Weimar Republic, is probably worth more than the cash that's in it.
That's caller Michael talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line about the impending trade war the US is about to start with all its so-called allies. The joys of it. Courtney Pavlov, with a K, didn't dream of running away to join the circus because she was born into a circus family and made her performance debut in the ring at age 7. Courtney joined Oliver Callan this morning to talk about what it was like growing up in the circus.
So my dad is actually Bulgarian.
Oh yeah.
So he wasn't from circus, but he actually ran away with the circus when he was 14. So he ran away with the circus and then ended up on a show in the UK. And then that show decided to come over to Ireland. And my mum is Irish. She was born into the circus. So she was on our show. And then they ended up meeting up. And then I was born.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the Pavlov is a Bulgarian name.
Bulgarian,
and
yeah.
He ran away and stayed there.
Yeah, he's been with it his whole life as well now.
That's quite wild.
Yeah.
That sounds like something from a different century, doesn't it?
I know,
it?
Yeah.
You're a young woman, so this is all quite recent, really.
Yeah.
And is it a hard life?
Yes, I think... When I was in it, I probably didn't realise how much, but only since I've left, I've realised how just crazy it was, really.
in a good way?
Both, good and bad,
okay,
I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a lifestyle. Like,
yes.
You know, sometimes you don't have electric, sometimes you don't have water. Like these things, even since being out now nearly 5 years, you know, things I'm still grateful for is hot running water and endless water. And,
really?
You know, these things that you don't even think about, being able to charge your phone after 12 at night. Like I couldn't, sometimes you wouldn't have access to these things because obviously you're traveling around so much. And
tell us how much of this, of your life does the circus take up? You only recently left the kind of the world or the lifestyle of traveling around.
So I left in lockdown.
Did you? That was only 5 years ago.
5 years ago,
so
yeah.
From the age of 7 up. It's a little bit like farming in some ways, isn't it? If you're old enough to do anything in the family business, they're going to put you to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically.
As soon as you can do it.
Is there an off season? Is there downtime when you were...
So basically, my family would work 11 months of the year.
Really?
Yeah. And then for the month off, when I finished school and I was around 16... I then started to go and work on other shows in Europe. So like Spain and Germany. And I would work there for Christmas season and then come back and work for the year. So I basically, I'd never had time off. Yeah, I worked 12 months of the year.
And what would the traditionally the circus people who've taken that month off the season, what would they do for that month?
Just kind of prepare, repair things for the season ahead. Yeah, still working.
Just not putting on a show.
Yeah.
And is there a kind of a family home? Is there a solid home or is it always
no, so
on the road?
We've never lived in a house. Like, we live in caravans full time 12 months of the year. So we would just park up in our yard, basically, and stay there for the month and then
that was
hit the road again.
That was your permanent home.
Yeah.
What about schooling and education?
So when I was 4, I started school, and basically the system was the Department of Education. Every week we'd be in a new town. So they would send out a different teacher every single week and they would teach me and my cousin 3 days a week for 2 hours a day. So basically, because it was one-on-one, we were able to be at the same level as kids that were in school every day for longer. So we had homeschooling up until we were 12, alongside doing shows and performing and working.
Wow.
And then I'll never forget one day we were doing class and the teacher said, okay, it's time for PE, go run around the caravan 6 times. I was just like, okay. So yes, we did that until we were 12, and then you couldn't do that for secondary school. So I had to go to boarding school and then for a year. And then I went to school in Letterkenny.
The boarding school for a year.
Yeah.
Can you say where that is?
It was in Monkstown.
Did you? That must have been an extraordinary shock to your system.
Oh my God! It was wild. It was so crazy. Like, even the simplest thing of having to put your hand up to ask a question took me so long to grasp, because I had never had to do that before. Yeah. So yeah, it was so crazy. Like, even leaving the environment that I was in to going to an environment with kids that have lived a completely different life than I have. I just stuck out like a sore thumb immediately.
Were you the curiosity in the room?
Yeah, I was. Well, I think when you're a child, especially, like, you just want to fit in. You want to be in the cool kids groups. And I was just like so different and just the weird kid, you could say. So it was definitely hard to kind of find my place there. I just felt like I never fit in, and I just didn't know how to, you know, in a lot of ways I was probably more mature than the kids because I had been working and, you know, I was always around adults. So
do they seem very immature to you?
Yeah, it kind of immature. And then in ways I was immature as well. Like, maybe my social skills weren't where they could have been if I had been around kids my age. It was maybe that I didn't know how to talk to them, or it was hard to socialise with them.
Was that a difficult year then?
Oh yeah, I hated going to school.
Did you?
Hated it.
Didn't make friends?
No, I made like friends where I could, like, I was kind of like a class clown. Like, I'm a born performer, so you know, I'm not exactly, I've never been shy, but it was hard because, you know, I'm still the kid from the circus. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, I don't think the kids necessarily thought, maybe they thought it was cool for a second, but it definitely, I did get a bit bullied and stuff while I was in school.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Ah, it's all right.
Was that difficult to cope with then when you went home?
Well, yeah, alongside, you know, my mum said I could dance before I could walk. So I couldn't wait to perform. I couldn't wait to be on stage. And when I started performing, I was living my dream life because I was doing what I loved. And then doing that every day to having to leave my family, who I'm surrounded by all the time, and go be in a boarding school and have authority from teachers that I'd never had before.
Yeah.
And, you know, struggle with friendships and stuff. It was definitely hard. I just wanted to be back on the circus performing.
And your family obviously recognised this, which is why you only did a year there in the end.
Yes.
Why Letterkenny then for the next school?
Because basically an auntie of mine has a house there.
Ah.
So I went to stay with her.
Right.
And yeah.
And do you continue working in the circus in between?
Yeah, so every weekend and summers I would go back.
Could have been anywhere in the country.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been very difficult to maintain, considering everyone else was probably relaxing the weekend and you were off working hard.
Yeah, pretty much. I didn't mind because it was what I was used to. Even now, if I have too much time off, I start to get uncomfortable because I'm so used to that
working.
Yeah, I love it.
You sound more and more like a farmer's kid as the chat goes on. And Letterkenny, this was a better experience in Letterkenny.
It was and it wasn't. The boarding school that I went to was maybe a higher class of people. And then going to...
As in a different society, a different world.
Yeah, a different world. Letterkenny, again, was a different experience. I think, again, in the circus, you're very secluded. You're kind of protected from everything because you're surrounded by your family all the time.
I see, yeah.
So when I went to Letterkenny then and I started to get a bit older and into my, you know, younger teen years, I was surrounded by things that I'd never heard of before, seen before. There was different things going on. And again, I just felt like this is not what I want to be doing, you know.
You're the outsider again.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you leave school.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do your junior cert?
No, I didn't. I left.
Did you really?
Yes.
At 16 when you could.
Yes. So basically.
Looking back now, do you regret that or?
Not at all.
El ne regret rien. Courtney Pavlov there talking about being raised in the circus with Oliver Callan this morning. Cuckoos will be arriving in Ireland over the next few weeks. And this morning, Niall Hatch, Head of Communications and Development with Birdwatch Ireland, joined Claire Byrne to talk about why cuckoos come here and why their numbers are diminishing.
So where is the cuckoo arriving from at the moment, firstly?
So they come from sub-Saharan Africa, and we've only found out quite recently, actually, through a tracking project by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, that they're actually coming from the Congo rainforest, from the Congo Basin. So they're travelling a long way to get here, really quite an epic journey.
And why are they making the journey?
Well, they're coming here to Ireland and to elsewhere in Europe in order to breed. Now, famously, of course, cuckoos don't make their own nest. So the male who does that cuckoo song that we just heard there, he's arriving in the next couple of weeks here into Ireland. He wants to try and intercept as many females as possible as they're migrating back. And then, of course, then they'll mate. The male's job is done then. The female will lay her eggs in the nests of other birds, will then return to Africa. So they really just come here just to breed and actually spend most of their lives in Africa. Mm-hmm. So it's very much an African bird that comes here.
So that sound that we just heard, that's the mating call.
And, that's right.
And the female hears that then and she can't resist it.
That's exactly right. So the male will try and position himself in a place where he would be able to broadcast over as wide a space as possible. So they tend to prefer open ground. Places like Connemara, the Burren, the Aran Islands are still very good for the cuckoos. They would have been much more widespread across Ireland and elsewhere. But as habitats become more fragmented, as places become more built up, it's actually harder for the cuckoo's call to carry. So the male wants to be in the jockeying for the best position where he can attract as many females as he can.
And who does? There's such a bad rep for the nest stealing. Does the nest stealing? Is it the male or the female? Or
it's entirely the female. So the male's sole job in the partnership, if you can even call it that, is the mating. And then his job is done. The female will then go and she will lay her eggs always in the nest of the same bird species that raised her when she was a chick.
Mm-hmm.
So this instinct is very strong there. As far as we know, there's no conscious thought in this. People do think of them being evil or bad, but they're just doing what comes naturally to them. The main host in Ireland is a bird called the meadow pipit, which is a relative of the wagtail. It's a brown streaky bird with speckles on its chest. It's very widespread in Ireland. Though it too is declining, and that's one of the reasons why cuckoos are also in decline. And many of our female cuckoos will lay their eggs in the nest of that bird. There's other ones we'll use another species called the dunnock, which is a more common garden bird, and there's other species as well. And she's evolved so that her eggshells will mimic the pattern of the host species. So that's why it's so important she puts them in the right nest.
Extraordinary. So yeah. They know exactly what they're doing.
Well, how much they actually know or how much is genetically coded instincts, we're not sure, but it seems that it very much so, if she lays them in the wrong nest, the parents will reject it. The egg is a lot bigger than those of the host species, but that doesn't seem to matter. The unwitting foster parents don't seem to notice that. It's the colour that gets them.
Right. OK, so they just say, we'll take the big egg. That's unusual. And we'll look after that chick as well. Now, we get the common cuckoo here. There's another species of or another type of cuckoo that goes to Spain. Is that right?
That's right. So within Europe, we have these two species, the common cuckoo, which unfortunately not living up to its name anymore, really in Ireland, no longer common. And then there's the great spotted cuckoo, which you find in parts of southern Europe and into Asia. And it also lays its eggs in the nests of other birds, but it usually uses magpies. So it's quite different. And there are many other cuckoos around the world, some of which lay their eggs in other birds' nests. We call that brood parasitism, and some don't. Some do build their own nests. But our European birds, the cuckoos, they never make their own nest.
Right. So tell me then about the declining numbers, which we're all very sad and sorry to hear. So the common cuckoo is on the way down in terms of what we're seeing coming to Ireland at this time of the year.
That's exactly right. And that's a common story, actually, for a lot of what we call our trans-Saharan migrants. So the birds that would nest here in Ireland and elsewhere in Europe and then spend our winter in sub-Saharan Africa. So probably the most familiar would be the swallow. Again, a common bird in Ireland, but one that's showing similar declines. But there's many other species in the same boat. They're not related to each other necessarily. The main thing is that they eat insects and they cross the Sahara. So climate change is playing a major major role there. Mm-hmm. Also, things like changes in habitat, particularly agricultural intensification in Ireland, that's played a big role in the decline of these species. And the cuckoos are hit by it for several reasons. The migration, of course, as the weather becomes more unsettled, as conditions change in the Sahara and in the Atlas Mountains and so on, that affects their migration. Then when they arrive back here, their main food are the hairy caterpillars of moths, which other birds don't eat. So they have the molt themselves. But climate change is affecting the emergence of those. They tend to be hatching out earlier than they would. It's going out of sync with the curlew breeding season, or excuse me, the cuckoo breeding season. What happens then as well is there's also then the impact on the host species. So the birds like the meadow pipit that the cuckoo relies on to lay its eggs in the nest of, they're becoming more fragmented, more spread out. They're declining too. So all of these things are hitting the cuckoo at once. So it's not a great picture for them, unfortunately.
Right. So it's just so circular. So that hairy caterpillar is crucial to the story of the cuckoo.
Absolutely. So these caterpillars, they've evolved these hairs that are very irritating. If humans touch them, they hurt our skin as well. Most birds won't touch them. But the cuckoos have evolved a special digestive system that allows them to eat them without any harm. So where those caterpillars are abundant, they do very well. And that's why cuckoos are still very common in places like the Burren, where there's so many native plants still where these caterpillars can live. But in the rest of Ireland, where we have a lot of agricultural monoculture and it's not very welcoming to many insects, that has a big impact on the food supply for the cuckoos and of the meadow pipits that host the babies as well. So it's, many things.
Okay, so you mentioned there the Burren is a good place to see them. Also Connemara.
Yeah, that's right.
Where else might we hear and see a cuckoo?
So luckily they do still breed in all 32 counties of Ireland, but the west and the southwest are the main areas for them. Killarney National Park is another very good spot for them. Parts of Donegal, particularly around Glenveagh, that's very good. On the east coast, Wicklow is still quite good. The Wicklow Mountains National Park around Glenslough, Lochdan, that kind of area. Also along the south coast, people will often hear, hopefully in the next couple of weeks actually, the first cuckoos that arrive in the likes of Wexford, Waterford and Cork, they will often stop for a few days just by the coast to try their luck, to try and intercept some females that come in before they then disperse further north throughout Ireland. Mm-hmm. So you can hear them pretty much anywhere. And some of the boglands in areas like Westmeath, Kildare, those kind of areas, Offaly, you can still hear them there too, but not like they used to. It used to be that you'd hear them in every parish in Ireland, and sadly that's no longer the case.
That's not happening now. Well, let's go back then to what happens when the female lays the egg in the nest
yes.
that she has decided is appropriate for her to do so.
Yes.
And you're explaining to us that her genetics tell her what's the right nest to choose. What happens then?
So what she does is she has to find that nest. So she might have picked it out where it is, but then she has to make sure that it's not occupied by the parent. So cuckoos, they're a larger bird than people expect. They're about the size of a pigeon. They're more slender, but they very much resemble a sparrowhawk. They look very hawk-like, even though they're not related to them. And it's thought that that's an adaptation to scare the bird that's sitting on the nest up, because a sparrowhawk has no interest in eating the eggs, no interest at all. It wants to catch a live bird. So the parent will flee to try and save themselves, thereby revealing their position and allowing a little window of opportunity for that female to come right in. What she will do is she will select an egg that's already in there. She'll usually eat it herself to replenish her own calcium and protein, and then she'll lay her own egg. And the whole thing just takes a matter of just a few seconds. She's in and out within 10 seconds.
So she gets rid of one and replaces it.
That's right.
Clever, isn't it?
Yeah. And then she'll go on and she'll do that maybe 15, 20 times. She's laying an egg every day, and then when she's done and her eggs are depleted, then she will fly back to Africa, because she doesn't need to be around to see what's happening with her offspring. She'll never see them.
She's like a deadbeat dad, but like for birds. That's Niall Hatch, Head of Communications and Development at Birdwatch Ireland, talking all things cuckoo with Claire Byrne this morning. Artist Geraldine Carton was on Liveline some time ago asking Irish women to send them pictures of their breasts so she could paint them. And they did just that, and Geraldine did her painting. And now there's a short documentary film about the whole endeavour called Boobs. Geraldine, along with two women who feature in the film, Nolene Slevin and Lima Murphy, joined Ray Darcy in studio this afternoon.
So Geraldine, go on. The why of all this?
The why? Well, I guess it all started with me doing an art course. And in the course, I was learning a lot about the history of art and particularly the way in which women had been portrayed throughout history in art. And I was noticing there's a lot of one particular type of woman being shown or portrayed in a very particular way, which was very one-dimensional, very white, very slim, very lacking much agency. And it made me think of actually today and how in modern media, the same kind of image and message prevails. And knowing the impact that this can have on women, myself included, and how negative these kind of messages can be on ourself and our sense of value and well-being. It made me feel compelled to make a project dedicated to raging against that machine, so to speak, and rebelling against that kind of image making and portraying women in a real way that actually reflected the way we saw ourselves. And the reason I chose boobs is because I felt that it was a perfect symbol for the discrepancy between how women's bodies are portrayed, i.e. boobs being a sex symbol, very sexualized, compared to how we experience our boobs, which is more often than not completely unsexual. It can be actually a really complicated relationship that we have with our boobs, you know, from childhood to teenagehood, the attention you suddenly get from growing boobs, the conversations that come about, having too big boobs or too small boobs, or what bra, are you wearing a bra or not? And then the older you get into adulthood, you know, even with your periods, they can be quite painful. But, you know, having children, and I haven't myself, but I've seen my friends and family and through this project learn so much more. But the way in which your boobs change through pregnancy, you know, breastfeeding, huge changes and a huge sacrifice as well. And then ultimately, they can kill you. And for all of that to be reduced down to sexy fun bags, it really felt like such a disrespect to women.
And historically, most artists were men.
Yeah, and the way they portrayed boobs was like, it's as if they had never seen real boobs, and maybe they hadn't, you know, they were like two tennis balls, you know, you'd never see uneven boobs or hairy nipples or stretch marks. So that's why I did think that it was a good symbol for show, okay, for the show, and it worked out pretty well in the end. Yeah.
So you got on Liveline and you spoke to Joe, and you put a call out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was important to me to get a great span and diversity of women, like a real representation of women in Ireland today, including all ages, sizes, skin tones, trans women, pregnant women, breastfeeding women, women who had mastectomies, lumpectomies. You know, I really tried so hard to get that range. And I think the show in the end reflected that huge range. And it was amazing seeing the women come in and see themselves reflected back at them.
And Lima, it's a friend of a friend or somebody that told you about it, was it?
Yeah, so Nicola, who produced the documentary, she's a friend of a friend. So she came to me and said, would you fancy getting involved in this? And I was like, maybe. But actually, it was a very simple yes, because I knew Nicola herself and I knew how she approaches topics, and I knew that she'd be a safe space and anybody that would come in on it would be also a safe space. Yeah. So, yeah, I said yes pretty quickly.
Right. And Nolene?
Yes. Like that, a friend recommended. She was friendly with Geraldine, and her daughter were friendly. And I had seen the call on Instagram, actually. And that prompted me then to get in touch with Geraldine.
Right.
And at the time, it was post-COVID, and I just sort of felt that I wanted to get involved in a project like that. Especially, I was doing, like Geraldine, doing a little bit of art thing on women and women's issues. So I felt that this was a very worthwhile project to get involved in. Right. And I'm really glad I did.
Yeah. So you've had a double mastectomy.
Yes.
Right. So when were you diagnosed with breast cancer?
Well, it's 20 years ago now, Ray. When I was 43, I found a lump in my breast and had the whole lumpectomy, radiotherapy, you know, that part of my life. And then afterwards, then, because there was a connection with ovarian cancer, my aunt had died with ovarian cancer. So we did the genetic testing at that stage. And then I had the BRCA gene. And then after that, it was like, you should have prophylactic hysterectomy, oophorectomy, and bilateral mastectomies, which I put off for a long while, because like Geraldine says, your breasts are very important to you. And especially, you know, after being a mother and you're breastfeeding and, you know, there's that, you don't want to let go, I suppose, really. But then you sort of think, well, if this is a chance of saving your life, that, you know, it's something that you should do. And that's why I opted to have the bilateral mastectomy at that stage.
Yeah, it's a big decision to make, isn't it?
It is a big decision, yes. And I'm very fortunate in that I have very supportive family and friends. And I know that it's not that easy for other people. And in a way, I'm very lucky in that I didn't have sort of chemotherapy to go through as well. So...
It was elective. You just, but
it,
you
it was recommended. It was a recommendation that you should look at doing it. Now, you know, I'm not sure if I would do it again, but at the time you feel that if it's something that's going to prolong your life.
Yeah. And you're still, you're here to tell the story.
I'm still here to tell the story, yes. Yes,
and
really
and you had reconstruction.
Yes.
And that didn't work out.
Well, one of the, it did, it worked, to a point, yes.
Right,
Yeah, but I mean, they're never quite the same as the breast tissue that you've had before. And obviously your nipples are gone and there's that sensitivity is not there anymore. So I don't think, like personally, I don't know, like it's 20 years ago now, obviously, and hopefully things have changed in that that's more in the discussion pre-surgery.
For
women,
yes, yes.
Undergoing that procedure.
What would you have done differently, I suppose, is the question then.
I suppose, I don't know, Ray, yeah. But I think having that information, you know, having that thought process before the procedure would be beneficial.
That's Nolene Slevin, who features in the short film Boobs about Geraldine Carton's painting project, along with Lima Murphy, and all three women were talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Boobs, the short documentary film about Geraldine's project, is debuting at the Catalyst International Film Festival in Limerick this weekend. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, there's a three-part documentary called Hooked on RTE Telly this week, which looks at all kinds of addiction, like gambling, alcohol and smartphones. It's presented by Brian Penny, who joined Oliver Callan this morning, along with his sister Anne. Brian has a history of addiction himself.
One thing I try to get across to people is, like, I was addicted to heroin for 15 years, other drugs for more, but I didn't really have a drug problem per se. I had an anxiety, a panic attack problem from trauma, and I was really medicating and self-soothing. So I think that's what a lot of people don't understand. The essence of addiction is really avoiding and escaping pain.
Right.
So really that's the journey I had. I used drugs to self-soothe. I used drugs to escape how I felt. And I was just in a different realm of reality for so long, trapped in that world. Functional addict for a lot of that time as well, but just really trapped in that world until I luckily found an escape.
The path out. You wrote and you've talked about the fact that how you were frightened of your own body, right down to your heartbeat and your breath. Can you break down that level of fear that you would have?
Yeah, so it's quite shocking actually. So I had an operation as an infant. I was only a couple of weeks old. But before 1985, this is quite shocking for people, that infants did not get a general anaesthetic when undergoing surgery. So I was awake undergoing surgery, like invasive surgery, where they were going in and sort of messing around with my intestines to put them back in place. So obviously I don't remember that. But what we know today is that the body keeps the score. It's the name of a great book. And even I'm 46 years of age today and I still have the urge to...
Today,
And I still have the urge to rub the scar, like even with that. And trauma just leaves a mark on the body. Like it changes your biology to how you respond to future threats and danger. And that's where the need to self-soothe was. And I grew up with a phobic fear of my heartbeat, my breath, my pulse. I was just so afraid of my own inner world, always anxious, always agitated, hence the need to escape that reality.
At the height of your addiction, somehow you managed to get a job and hold it down, hold it together, longer than you might expect.
Yeah, it's crazy. Ironically, I worked in for Big Pharma, funnily enough, designing methadone and anti-anxiety medication. That's
unbelievable.
A very ironic part of the journey. But I was good at my job when I was awake, in inverted commas, like, which is a crazy thing to say. But I was sort of technical. I suppose I was always, I wouldn't say academic, but I applied myself to things and I was good at my job. But an awful lot of enabling went on in the workplace. Like I got on great, had some great friends in the workplace and they really protected me. So when I looked really stoned or when I was really unwell, they sort of hid that in a way to protect me because they were trying to look after me. And that enabling can have a big role in the workplace and in family dynamics as well.
That's extraordinary, Ellen. Yeah. It's hard to believe. Anne is here. You're the baby girl of the Penny household.
I am, three older brothers.
Do you remember, how do you view Brian through, well, how did you view Brian first of all before his troubles? What was the dynamic like between yourself?
We were great pals, like we were all great pals growing up, and Yeah, there's 8-9 years between us, and then 12 years between my eldest brother. So like there was a big age gap, where those kind of Brian and Kelvin were raised, you know, and then me and James were kind of raised separately. Not separately, but like it was just a different dynamic at and different times. So yeah, really felt like that, like the big brother, the older brother, and like really looked up to himself and his friends, and Westlife were big at the time, so they were kind of emulating that as well, like that age. So yeah, we really looked up to him, like, yeah, definitely.
And he was smart, you could tell.
Yeah, always kind of had smarts about him, like in different ways. So yeah, like definitely had smarts about him, all right.
When did your relationship then with Brian begin to change?
Things changed, I'd say, around my teenage years. So like my own kind of, I would have been out with my own friends and drinking with my own pals. But like, you know, Brian would have always looked out for me. But then we started around my teenage years. I kind of started to see that there was something else going on, and right. that he wasn't around as much, or he wasn't picking up on things as much, or, you know, so we didn't have the same relationship, you know, that was kind of starting to separate.
He's sort of stopping your big brother, the shoulder to lean on, I suppose. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. Like I would have really felt like that he would have been one of a person I could go to with any issues, but I didn't have that kind of that connection was gone at that point.
And home was Blanchardstown, was it, up around?
Yeah,
very strong community there. You'd be used to kind of leaning on each other, particularly within family.
Definitely. It was a great little community when we got there, because there was a lot of families put into an area, and it was in the middle of nowhere at the time. So there was a great community spirit, and everyone looked after each other, and especially with the family dynamics and our extended family as well. We all really looked out for each other.
Yeah, our extended family is amazing. Like, especially my mum's side of the family, they've been so helpful to us over the years. Yeah.
Brian, when you were addicted to heroin, smoking heroin is what you're doing. And you would have seen Anne, you would have witnessed him on the nod, is the phrase they use, isn't it?
Goofing off.
Yeah. Goofing off. Yeah. What does that look like to anyone who hasn't seen it?
It's quite subdued, like it's quite relaxed. It's not like a manic drug, like it doesn't make you kind of excited, but it's hard to watch in the sense that, you know, he'd be tickling his face a lot and then just kind of like goofing off at the table, but very much believing that he's okay. And then like we'd wake him up and he'd be kind of snap back into him, be like, oh no, I'm all right. Like, but, so it was quite hard to watch. And that was very much near the end that was becoming more like out in within the family. Like,
is,
you know,
it used to
be something that was happening like up in the bedroom, but it was becoming that it happened at the kitchen table now.
Would you be able to discuss it as a family at all, or was it something that was just taboo?
Yeah, it was hard because it was kind of not really fully understood or really known what was going on. Like everybody kind of had an inkling, but it wasn't like out on the table that we were able to discuss it as a family. And it was quite difficult. Like it was quite difficult, you know, for my parents and for my brothers and for myself to probably even accept that that's the reality. This is what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like,
that's Anne Penny, who, along with her brother Brian, joined Oliver Callan in studio this morning to talk about the 3-part documentary on addiction that's airing on RTE TV this week, called Hooked. And that's all I have for you on this Fool's Day edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the Mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday, when Sinead Mooney has a superior in every way look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.